The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is January 25th, 2008, and this is episode number 112, and I am Bob Hayes, your host, here this week to talk about some of the latest, greatest, good stuff in MotoGP, and with some other stuff going on in this show as well. So before we start on the rest of the show, I want to send a big, giant shout-out thank you to Marcus Brook, Richard Zane, James Jones, Ian Carty, and J. Travis Hinson, all of whom donated to MotoGPOD this past week. It's been a nice week for donations. Thank you very much, guys. And I got to say, Travis Hinson has donated three times now. So I think that puts him in the podium club of the donations or something along those lines. Might have to make up some different sort of things going on. But thanks a lot, Travis. I do appreciate it. I exchanged a few emails with Travis and said, I feel kind of guilty, dude. You know, you're sending me all these donations and everything. And he sort of, you know, expressed that, you know, he likes the show. And when he can afford it, he's you know, supports me a few bucks my way to help pay for the hosting bills or the beer tab or whatever it is. So this is good stuff. I do appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much, Marcus, Richard, Travis, James, and Ian. And let's see what else we got on tap today. We have some other good stuff. I've got a long call with Darren Carpenter, our OMRA representative from the Oregon Motorcycle Road Racing Association up there, racing at PIR and all that. We've had Darren on the show several times before, and we're just getting such a great positive response about all this track day chit-chat that we decided to continue with it. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the more the things you might not think about necessarily with track days, including gear and insurance. Oddly enough, we did a little bit of research about insurance, and it sounds, you know, like a big snoozer, but it's pretty important stuff. And I think, you know, it's a worthy listen. The gear stuff is excellent, of course, and the insurance stuff is excellent. Oh, it's good. It's a good chat, and we got that coming up in the show. And then we have also some testing happened in Sepang. MotoGP season is coming along because the teams are back out doing the testing. Just finished up 3 days of testing in Malaysia at the Sepang circuit. That was on January 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that, going to touch on it briefly. And they are going to Phillip Island next week, the teams. So we're going to have that for the next show. And speaking of which, a little reminder, like I said last week, not going to do a show on the February 1st, next Friday, because I have a Navy school that I've got to be going to, and I just can't guarantee that I'll have the bandwidth and all of that sort of thing. So rather than try to sort of say, yeah, I'm going to do a show, I'm just not. So going to miss February 1st, but we will be back on February 8th. So let's see, moving on. What else we got going on here? Some of the stuff we've been talking about in the last several shows is the Barry Sheen documentary that's been on Biography Channel in the UK. And I was fortunate enough to see this show. It was excellent. It was really good stuff. I laughed. I cried. It was better than Cats. And basically, it's a really interesting guy. One of the first of the real sort of superstars to work his stardom to his own advantage in many ways was old Baz Luhrmann. And it's just a super interesting guy. It was a very, very enjoyable hour. Now, here in the States, Biography Channel not showing the show, which is a ripoff. So I encourage you to go to the biography.com and submit the form. I never heard back from them other than their automated canned replies of, yeah, this will be sent to the appropriate person. Yeah, sure, whatever. After watching the show, it's sort of British enough that I kind of doubt it will ever get over here. There's enough slang and things like this that for the mainstream U.S. viewer who has never heard of Barry Sheen or never heard of MotoGP for that matter, it's not going to be interesting enough. So I'm sad to say, I kind of doubt that Biography is going to go out on that big limb and, you know, maybe take off the show about, I don't know, Britney Spears or some crap in order to show the Barry Sheen documentary. I wish they would, but I kind of doubt they will. However, all hope is not lost for watching that program if you happen to reside in the United States. I had emails from a couple of listeners. Let's see. We had Graham Boodle and Paul Meadows both sent me a heads up on this one. That episode, that Barry Sheen documentary that they're showing on the Biography Channel in other countries, is actually taken from a DVD that's available at Duke Video. So if you're not familiar with Duke Video, they do those MotoGP season review videos. They do just all kinds of great stuff. And they have the English site and the American site. Not everything is available on the American site. So you got to go to the English website. You could buy the DVD there. One word of advice. The DVD is PAL, which is the European television standard. And unfortunately, I could not find anything on the website talking about regions, because DVDs have both television standard and region. The television standard is not a big deal. You can watch a PAL DVD on your computer with no worries at all. And if you can hook your computer up to your television, chances are it's going to work fine. Here in the United States, dual standard DVD players are extremely rare, so I doubt that you can play a PAL DVD in your regular old home DVD player, but being able to watch this show on your computer is better than not at all. I have purchased, or actually I've received, a British Superbikes season review that was PAL, and it had no region. It was region zero, so it will play in any DVD player as long as that DVD player will play PAL. And like I said, if you run it on the computer, it's going to work fine. So if you want that Barry Sheen documentary, it's a two-disc set, so there's a lot more stuff than just the one-hour thing. You can find that at dukevideo.com. Just search for Legacy. And, of course, I will also put a link up on the MotoGPOD.com website. But if you go to dukevideo.com, search for Legacy. It's the Barry Sheen documentary, a legacy of greatness or something along those lines. And it was really, really good stuff. It's about 20 pounds, which is pretty close to $40 nowadays, and you're going to spend shipping on top of that. But it's well worth watching. And along those lines, let's talk a little bit about BitTorrents. Another listener sent me in this little tip, which I should have thought of this one, and I'd forgotten about this. But David Spaulding mentioned, he says, I heard you talk about hitting the torrent sites to find some hard-to-find videos. And I have mentioned these things here and there, that TVU.com and some of these other things. He says, perhaps you're already aware, but the site below is by far the best I have found, and that is racing-underground.com, racingunderground.com. And from there, you can find a variety of different torrents of racing-related videos and things like that. Now, I somewhat have an issue with BitTorrent in general because of my job. As many of you may know, I work in the video industry here in the United States, working for a stock footage company, and we fight the piracy and all of that on the torrent site. So I tend to avoid them. So I don't have a whole lot of direct experience with it. I can't tell you that, hey, I've done it and I've gone to it and it works just great and all of that. So your mileage may vary, but it's one place to look for some of this stuff that we just can't get. And I don't think that's, you know, immoral or breaking the law or anything when you just like, look, I would pay for this, or I would watch this with commercials or whatever, but you guys won't show it to me. So go check it out, racing-underground.com. For another source of things like that Barry Sheen video, things like, who knows, you can probably find all sorts of great stuff up there, including maybe the Eurosport commentaries, MotoGP, all that kind of stuff. So thanks a lot, David, for reminding me of that one. Then let's see what else we got going on in the old mailbag as we rummage around through it. Got a long and interesting email from Ian Cardi, who was also mentioned in the donations earlier on. And this is kind of touching on the whole Barry Sheen and the long way around and all that goodness. One thing he says, first of all, he says, I heard you mention in episode number 111 about the long way round and talking about Long Way Down, which was the other one with Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman, excuse me. And he says, don't bother with the Long Way Down. He says, Long Way Round was a superb documentary. Excellent stuff. However, Long Way Down is a pile of watered down rubbish. The support crew is so much larger. The quote unquote hazards are so banal, and the ride itself, which should have been a superb experience, was just so boring. And it might have been because of the television channel that aired the Long Way Down was overly safe, talking about health and safety and so forth. But in any case, it's not worth wasting any of your good American dollars on. Well, thank you very much for that advice, Ian. I do appreciate it. But Ian also recommends Race to Dakar. And this is one I'd forgotten about. And this is from the producers a long way around. And this follows Charlie Borman's efforts to ride in the Dakar rally in 2006. And that... I followed it out a little bit when he was doing that in 2006. I didn't have the best of experiences. Old Charlie Borman didn't, but the DVD is supposed to be pretty good. Ian's recommending it, so that's a kind of a good thing, something to think about. And you can find these videos. Those ones are mainstream enough. You should be able to find them in the United States here at Amazon or what have you. For the Barry Sheen documentary, you are going to have to go to a British website. So dukevideo.com, amazon.co.uk, some of those kind of things you should have no problem. Like I said, even though it is PAL, it will play in your computer, will not play in your home DVD player. All right, enough boring on about video standards and things like that. Let's talk a little bit more about something that Ian Cardy mentioned further down his email, and I think this is a good cause, so I'm going to jump up on the MotoGPOD soapbox because I have one, and I can do that now and then. And Ian tells me about a charity event that he's doing. He says he's riding from London, which for those of us in America, that's in the UK, to Cannes in France, which Cannes, and down in the south of France. It's 1,500 kilometers or so, and he's riding. But oddly enough, he's not riding a motorcycle. He's riding a bicycle, and he's doing it in 5 days. So 1,500 kilometers, that's what, 900 and some miles? And that's a fair distance, 200 miles a day in the saddle. So he's going to be pedaling the whole way on his, and here's my French pronunciation, absolutely no idea, Specialized Robi Competition. And he's cycling all the way. And the event he's partaking in is called the Cycle to Cannes. And it's cycle numeral to Cannes. And he's going to be riding the whole event. He's going the distance. So many of the other riders in this event will be doing a relay and everything. But Ian's going to do the entire distance, riding all the way himself. And it's all for charity. Four different charities. And these are all UK charities, but they do great things all over the world. Architects for Aid, the Tom App Rees Price Memorial Trust, the Sarah Matheson Trust, and Land Aid. Now, more details about these charities are available at the official cycle2can.org website, which, of course, I will put a link on the website at MotoGPOD, but it's cycle numeral 2 cans with two N's, E-S on the end, and then a .org. And you can donate to the cause if you'd like to do that, if you'd like to send a little bit of money to these great charities, and it's in Ian Cardy's name, so there's a form you fill out, and you say, yeah, I'll donate £10 or £20 or whatever you can afford, and the credit card will charge you the equivalent. And just mention in the comment form that it's for Ian Cardy, I-A-N-C-A-R-D-Y, and that way it sort of goes into his overall fundraising budget thing, because anybody that rides 1,500 kilometers on a bicycle, and as Ian told me also, he said, I was just taking off for work, and I've got a 60-mile ride ahead of me, to go about 5 miles linear distance. So I think this guy's pretty competitive. So he's going to want to be able to say, look, I raise more money than you. So if you do donate money at cycle2cans.org, make sure you mention Ian's name. Fellow MotoGPOD listener, these are all great charities. I'm a big fan of charity. I'm a big fan of donations, as you can tell. And while, I appreciate the donations that you guys send to me, I really, really do. The donations that you send to these real charities that go to things for people where, these are people that need to eat or need to get an incurable disease cured or whatever. Whereas, mine goes for a podcast or for a track bike or things like that. So, big difference in the level of importance. So, the Cycle to Cannes and these sort of charities are good things. So good on you, Ian. Best of luck when you do that ride in March. It takes place March 6th to 11th. And I do encourage everybody, if all the MotoGPOD listeners would go up there and donate, make a small donation, a few bucks at the cycle2cans.org, then that would mean that Ian got, broke his personal goal of charity fundraising, and that would be a really, really good thing. So why don't you guys think about that? All right. Enough chatter on about bicycling, which this show is not about at all. And let's talk a little about testing. So like I said, they were down in Sepang. We had a few surprises. Testing is testing. It always is. And as I've said, I've been just extremely swamped busy lately, so was not able to follow the testing as thoroughly as I'd like to have, but there has been a lot of interesting news. First off, let's see, on the first day, Pedrosa had a crash, broke his hand, broke a bone, a metacarpal bone in his hand, went back to Spain, got that looked at, got surgery going on, got a titanium plate put along the bone there, so that's going to be affecting things for a little while for him. It obviously kind of put a kibosh on his testing in Sepang and no doubt also at Phillip Island next week, but he might be back for the following test, which I believe, if I recall correctly, was it Jerez? I can't remember. Liam said that, and I don't have it in front of me. So that was on day one that Pedrosa had that problem. We also had a couple other crashes. Rossi crashed on day one, a fairly good one apparently. And because, you know, Rossi crashes are not the norm, this one got quite a bit of press. Lorenzo also crashed, but they barely mentioned that. And talking about other things that happened on day one and actually on day two, you'll never guess who the fastest guy on the timesheets both day one and day two was. It was Randy Dupuynier. Randy Dupuynier was on fire those first couple of days. Actually, strictly speaking, Danny Pedrosa was on fire because his bike caught fire when he had that crash on day one. But Randy Dupuynier was on fire on the track, and he did a really, really good job. I'm not going to go down every test time or anything like that. This is just testing and the first test of the season, so it's all But needless to say, the riders were trying a lot of different things out, trying new tires, trying new setups, all sorts of things. We had some kind of shake-up stuff going on. It's going to be an interesting season. I really hope that we have a fantastic opening like we did last year, where the first, you know, it's just, this is the best season in years. Oh, my God. So why don't we cover, though, for day three, the final day of the test, let's talk a little bit about the test times on that day. Because, let's see, rider number one with the fastest time of the 3 days was none other than Nicky Hayden riding the Honda. Now, here's an interesting little side note about that whole thing. He got that time, which was a 2 minutes flat .326. It's a full 2 seconds faster than his day two time. He shaved 2 seconds off in one day on there. And it's on qualifier tires, but that's a spectacular time. He also had a really, really good time on race tires, which I don't have right in front of me. But the interesting thing about that whole stuff was that he got that time on the regular spring valved engine in the RC212V. They were running a pneumatically valved engine, and they were also running an engine with standard spring closed valves in the 2008 RC212V. And they were trying to both engines back to back, sort of checking some stuff out. And unfortunately, Hayden says that the pneumatic valved engine is just simply not fast enough yet. One thing about it, though, is it does make the bike more maneuverable. So the Honda feels that pneumatically valved engine is the way to go, and they're going to be working on it. But apparently they need to get something going as far as the horsepower department, because Hayden's finding, and he's turning out the best times on basically the wrong bike. And there's a really, really good story on crash.net all about that. Hayden takes the fastest time at Sepang, but on the wrong bike. So I encourage you to check that one out too at crash.net. Let's see. Other times that we had going on for the day three, the best fastest time. Second fastest time, Casey Stoner. Stoner did well all 3 days of the test. He was, like fifth on day one and fifth on day two, and managed to pull it up to second there on day three. And, the usual sort of chit chat about how they're doing, testing various different things and what he thinks about the tires and all that sort of good stuff. So I'm not going to read a lot of these quotes. Most of them are very PR-esque, but it was still interesting stuff. Let's see. Third fastest guy on day three, Jorge Lorenzo for the Yamaha, Rossi's teammate, who also crashed on day one, like I mentioned earlier before. But it's going to be kind of an interesting one between Rossi and Lorenzo. I really do think so. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. It's going to be interesting stuff. The Michelin tire guys, at least here in Malaysia at Sepang, first test of the season, doesn't really mean a whole lot. But if we can take anything from it, Michelin has seemed to have somewhat stepped up the game a bit, because these top several times are, you know, heavily weighted towards the Michelin guys, and that's kind of interesting. Spot number four was Colin Edwards on Yamaha. So out of the top four riders, three of them are on Michelins. John Hopkins, fifth. John Hopkins was doing okay, that kind of times all weekend long, as he was riding out on the Kawasaki and all of that. Sixth spot, Valentino Rossi. Rossi never quite, you know, did as far as the timesheets were concerned. He didn't set the world exactly on fire. Day one, he was sixth. Day two, he was third. Day three, he was sixth. He might be having his own set of tires. He's the only Yamaha out there on Bridgestones. So, you know, he's got new things to learn, all sorts of stuff. Let's see, what does he say on day three? The overall balance of the three-day test has been very positive. Working in many different areas, we tested the pneumatically valved engine in the Yamaha as well, and I have a good feeling from it. And blah, 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 kind of blah. Bridgestone on tires, we found some positive things here. We need to improve our performance with a qualifying tire. We need more time to better understand how to set up our bike with the soft tires, and so we're going to continue to work on this next time. We've given a lot of information to Bridgestone this week, so I'm sure that Bridgestone is going to basically whip up the special Rossi tires. And we look forward to more work together next time. And he completed a race simulation as well, which is good stuff, that they're doing all that kind of thing there on the testing right away. And overall, my pace was better than in the race last year, even though I had to slow down for a little bit in the middle because it was so hot. So, blah, 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 very happy in his form. It's a good test for us, yada, yada. And let's see who else we got going on there. Some other interesting, worthy people of note. Andrea Dovizioso on a Honda came in seventh fastest spot there on day three testing. He's getting off to a pretty good start for his rookie MotoGP season in the Premier class, at least. And I'm trying to find a little bit of a quote machine going on here for Dovizioso, and it's escaping me. So we're going to move on. James Toseland came in eighth on the Yamaha Tech 3 Yamaha, doing quite well out there. So, you know, Tech 3 might be a team to watch this year. Now that they've got good tires, you've got Colin Edwards, excellent racer, and Toseland, also excellent racer. Once he finds that rhythm and everything, I mean, he's new to this motorcycle. He's new to MotoGP, so he's doing quite well up there. Chris Vermeulen on the Suzuki, Loris Capirossi on the other Suzuki, 9th and 10th fastest on the day three there, with times of 201.778 and 201.873, respectively. Shinya Nakano riding the Honda did real, real well. Cucini Honda out there, although he only picked up the 12th spot there on day three. He was ninth on day two and 10th on day one. So, you know, he's getting up there. At least he's in the top half. And DeAngelis came in 13th on the Honda, fastest. Marco Melandri on the Duck was 14th fastest, way, way down there comparatively on the day three. And let's see, where was he on day two? 16th, and not in the top 10 on day one. So Melandri's kind of still getting to grips with his Duck. We'll see how that things work out for him. I do look for better stuff, better performances from him. Ant West, 15th fastest on the Kawasaki. Tony Elias on the Pramac Ducati, 16th. Olivier Jacques, test riding for Kawasaki, was 17th fastest. Sylvain Gattoli on the other Pramac Ducati was 18th fastest on day three. And Nicolo Canepa, test rider for Ducati, 19th. And Tamaki Serizawa, another Kawasaki test rider. Kawasaki had a pretty good size contingent going on out there in Sepang. So those are some testing news, a little bit of testing times. Like I said, big things, big events that we had going on from that particular three-day thing were Pedrosa breaks his hand and gets a plate put in it, motorcycle catches on fire, several people crashed, and Hayden picks up the fastest time of the test on the wrong motorcycle with the spring-valved engine instead of the pneumatic valves. And so Honda needs to go back and do a little bit of homework going on around that. So, all right. Let's go moving on. Why don't we go ahead and listen to Darren and I talk a little bit about track day stuff. Well, all right. We got Darren Carpenter on the phone with us today. Darren Carpenter is our team racer that races up there in the OMRA series in Portland. Been on the podcast a couple times. Hello, Darren. How you doing?
Good. How are you, Bob?
I am also good. Thank you very much. We've been talking a little bit here right up before we hit the record button, and so Darren and I have both enjoyed, well, I know I have enjoyed a couple of beers, and I think Darren may have. So, but we're going to talk about track day stuff because this has been a real popular topic. Like I've said in a few shows before, it seemed like a lot of listeners out there are just interested in the whole thing, and Darren's got such a wealth of experience, and he's kind of my mentor, so it's pretty good stuff. One thing I'd like to start off this little chit-chat with, Darren, if we can, is that I got an email from, it is from Dan Jassa. Not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but Jassa, J-A-S-A. And he sent me an email. And amongst one of the things he's saying, he says, one thing to mention, he says it's a, I see a lot of guys that come to the track. They're big back road riders and they think they're really fast. But I think this is a big mistake most of these guys make is that they're going in with the wrong attitude. They think they know what they're doing. I'm faster than you are. Don't tell me what to do. I've been riding like this my whole life, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of these times these people are very fast, but they need to go to the track with the idea of learning from others. And one of the main problems that these people experience, and Dan goes on to mention it, is that, target fixation, which we've all heard about. You know, if you've done any kind of motorcycle training, read Keith Coates books, anything, you know what target fixation means, which is as soon as something bad happens in front of you, that's where you're looking. And as I've done five track days, and I haven't had a crash happen directly in front of me where I could actually see the guy going down. But I did have one happen behind me down there at Thunder Hill, and I know I looked around and what the hell was that? And but you have, Darren. So what is that first instinct that you get? You see somebody all of a sudden going down in front of you.
Target fixation is something that you have to really, you have to kind of work at. And so one of the reasons why I say people should do a track day is to help get over that fact. When you're on the track, you're going to have people around you, you're going to have things around you, but you're going at a faster pace than you are on the street. So you're going to have to keep focused on looking forward and looking down the track. And one of the differences is when you're riding on the street, if you're just let's say you're riding to work and back, you're a commuter. You know, there's not going to be that many times while you're commuting where somebody's going to crash right in front of you, or another bike's going to come up right next to you as you go into a turn, or cut you off on the inside or cut you off on the outside. I mean, those things do happen on the street, but if you consider the course of, say, a month that you're driving to work, and you drive to work and back every day, it's 20 miles maybe each way. That's 40 miles round trip, and you do that 30 times a day or 30 times a month. The likelihood is maybe once or twice you're going to get cut off by a car, going into a turn. And you're probably not going to see anybody crash around you. Well, at the track, you're going to have people around you at a much closer proximity a lot more often. And so that's going to help you get prepared for a situation where you're going to get more comfortable with that situation. And when you go on the street and you're riding to work, when that happens, you're going to be more prepared. You're going to be less shocked, and you're going to be able to stay focused on what you're doing. So I think that's one of the good reasons about doing a track day, is because you can put yourself in a situation where you're going to have to focus and stay focused on looking ahead and looking down the track and not fixating on bikes right around you. When you first start doing track days, I think the first thing you're going to have to get comfortable with is bikes within close proximity of you. If you're going into a turn, there's going to be people that are going to be making passes on you, coming up on the inside, going around the outside, and it's the same for every level, A, B, or C group in the track day. It's just a little bit different for every group, but it's still the same shock. When you're in the C group and you're first starting off with track days, if somebody's within 5 feet of you, you're like, whoa, where's that, where'd that guy come from? And it's kind of shocking to you because you're just new to the whole experience. And then after you get used to that and you move up to the B group and now they're within, 2 feet of you, you're like, whoa, this guy's really close, and you get used to that. And then as you progress along and you do more and more track days, and if you ever do move up to the A group and now they're, basically rubbing elbows with you, the first time that happens, you're like, oh my gosh, like this guy's right on me. And again, you get used to that over and over. So, target fixation is something that I think you just have to get used to. You do want to look ahead. One of the things that Keith Code, I've mentioned his name a few times, but I'm not necessarily trying to promote his classes, but he does mention that you want to look as far ahead as you possibly can. If you're looking forward, through a turn, you want to look all the way through the turn to where you can't see where the track's going. That's, you want to look as far forward as you possibly can. And so while you're doing that, if things are right around you, you're not, you don't want to pay attention to those. You're not looking at what's right around you. You're looking at where you're going off into the future. So, if you are looking at stuff that's right around you, it's not going to help you, because by the time you can react to something, you can't react. You can't react that fast. The only way you can react around a track is by looking as far ahead as possible. If you look as far ahead as you possibly can, then you're looking maybe about 2 seconds off into the future. And if something happens 2 seconds off in the future, you have time to react to it. But if something happens right next to you within a 5-foot perimeter, your reaction time would have to be a split second, and it would be impossible to react to that. And then as far as somebody crashing, that's going to happen. And if you could do enough track days, you're going to have that experience. But again, it's really not anything you can prepare for ahead of time. But the whole process is, even before that happens, is to just focus on what you're doing, look as far ahead as possible, and so when stuff happens around you, you get comfortable with it, happening around you, and you know it's happening, you can hear it or you can see it, but you're still focusing way down ahead of the track. One of the things when you watch like an AMA race or a MotoGP race, you know, those guys, they get, when they're going through a turn, they're using the entire track. They're taking their wheels from, you know, edge to edge, and it's, and a lot of times they're even running off the edge. They're, you know, they're pushing so hard. Well, you know, as a racer, I know that when I'm going around the track, when I get that close to the edge of the track, the first few times I did it, it's alarming because it's like, well, I'm getting close to the edge of the track here. But what you have to realize is those guys, they don't ever see themselves close to the edge of the track because they're looking way far ahead. And, you know, they're not, they don't notice that they're up on the rumble strips because they're already 2 seconds ahead or 4 seconds ahead down the track if that's where they're looking.
Right, right. And that was an excellent answer, Darren. That was very, very well put. One thing that's always puzzled me is that, and in the racing situation, much more than track day or daily riding, is how, and we've talked about this one before too, but I still, like I said, it almost shocks me, the level of trust that you got to have in the other guy. When he's right on your ass, right there, you know, and things like that, or when you're on right on him, and you just have to sort of do, like I say, you have to trust him that he's not going to do something insanely stupid. Is that something that took you a while to work up to get used to, and to work up to that level of trust as a racer?
Well, I think you work up to it just the more you race around other people. And so the first few years that I raced in the middleweight class. I was on an SV, and, you know, the first year I raced, I didn't know anybody. I didn't really have any trust, and I was also just new into the track, so I was just trying to do the best I could. The second year, the third year that came around, you know, I had moved up in the positions. You know, the first year I was struggling to get a top 10, the second year I was struggling to get a top 5, and the third year I was, you know, trying to get a win, and I was finishing on the podium. And when I was at that point, and each time you're kind of moving up, you kind of know who's around you, you know. So when you're trying to finish in the top 10, you know, okay, I want to beat, you know, this guy, Joe Blow. He's finishing ahead of me a few times, and then you beat him, you move up. But when you're in, you know, if you're finishing in the top 10, you're really not in a close proximity. At least I wasn't with those guys. But when we got up to the trying to get a win and you're fighting for first place, you know, the split times, I even calculated a few times by looking at the lap, the finishing results. You know, we'd have five guys that would finish within 0.3 seconds. So that's five guys really close together, and we're really close together the entire race. And it was the same five guys, and so you knew them. There was never a point where you kind of mentally say to yourself, okay, I know I've raced with these guys, I know I'm going to trust them, you know, I know what they're going to do. It was more of, okay, I really want to finish ahead of them. And if, you know, I've been racing with these same guys, you know, battling with these same guys now. And so now I've been finishing in fifth place, and I got to finish. I want to get in front of this guy. You know, I'm going to finish in fourth place. Well, to do that, you're going to have to be really tight in there because they're all tight in there. And, you know, I remember a few times, I think most racers I know, when I've talked to them about it, it's funny if you could actually record our thoughts that are going through our head. You know, we're screaming inside of our helmets trying to get by people. And, you know, I remember there was one race where there was one guy who consistently was better than me. And so I would just be so frustrated and so, you know, would try to beat him so bad that, you know, we'd go through the turns and I would be less than a bike, you know, less than a tires width distance behind him, you know, less than like 2 feet. And I would stay right in that same spot the whole time. And in my head, I'm thinking, I'm just going to run into this guy. Like, I'm so pissed off at not being able to beat him. And so I would go around the track and I would get on the throttle as soon as I could, like out of every turn. And I could never close that gap, you know, because he was going as fast as he could as well. And so, you know, at that point, yeah, it's kind of a trust thing because, you know, if he missed a shift, or if he, you know, if he slipped out of gear, we were so close together that I wouldn't have been able to avoid him. I would have run into him. But at the same time, it wasn't like I was, you know, thinking in my head, I trust this guy to do the right thing. I'm thinking I just want to get by him. And there was a race, you know, several years ago with when Rossi and Sette were battling that year, and there was one particular race where Sette, like the last corner, Sette accused Rossi of slowing down, like in the middle of the turn. Uh-huh. And And he actually, I think, hit his front, Sete's front wheel up against Rossi's back wheel. And I remember when they came across the line, Sete's front fender was actually turned to the side. It was obvious that he ran into him. And there was some discussion, or, you know, I'm sure some words said after that race, because he thought Rossi did it on purpose, and Rossi claimed he didn't. But that's the same kind of situation. Those guys are racing so hard, and they're trying to beat each other, you know, with everything they have, that there's just no room for error. And whether Rossi did it on purpose or whether he did it on accident, there's not anything you can do as far as if you're the second-place person. You know, you have to try to get around them, and that's just part of the game.
Yeah, so interesting. It's a good way to put it, that, you know, that it's not – and I kind of understand what you're saying. It's, you know, with the whole sort of, like I said, not so much an outright – trust, like, you know, he's my, you know, band of brothers kind of thing or anything, but just sort of a knowledge that he's at the same sort of level as you are, so as long as you can rely on yourself, you could rely on him. But well, in any case, on the track, whether you're doing track days or races or that sort of thing, there is a possibility that things are going to happen, and you have to prepare yourselves for these eventualities. And a couple of things we wanted to talk about a little bit were gear and insurance. And I know that insurance sounds like somewhat of a, like, oh boy, let's talk about insurance, but it's actually a question that comes up a lot. And I've had a few people email me, and you've had people talking to you about it, Darren. So we did a little bit of research. So basically, do you want to discuss gear first, or do you want to talk a little bit about what we found out about insurance first?
Let's talk about insurance, because it is something I know when I first started racing, I didn't really, or even doing track days, I didn't consider insurance. But I know just from, you know, being that I do work with PSSR as an instructor, and people who've never done track days before, they'll ask me about it, and they're, you know, they're street riders, and the question of insurance comes up. You know, what happens if I get into a crash? You know, what you know, and so, yeah, let's talk about insurance.
Right on. So, as a track day guy, you're doing your first track day. What does happen if you get into a crash, Darren?
Well, you know, I called a few places, and you called a few places, a few insurance things. And the first thing I want to recommend is that if you have questions about it, we called and we got varying answers from different places, and some of them, you know, some of the answers I got, I kind of was like, I wonder if that's really what they would do. You know what? Is this guy just trying to sell me insurance? And so they say they're going to cover you. And actually, when you get into an accident, you know, I don't necessarily like insurance companies just because of some of the bad rap they've gotten in the past. But you need to call your own insurance company and just be frank with them and tell them what you're doing and tell them what you have and find out what the answer is. You know, I know a lot of times, I know for myself, there was times in the past where I wanted to get life insurance or Aflac, you know, the supplemental insurance. And when I called them on the phone, I'm thinking, I don't want to, you know, try to be gray with what I do as far as a hobby on the side. I don't want to try to hide that fact, because I know that if I do get into an accident and it comes out, they're likely just to say, hey, we didn't know that, and we don't cover that. And so I was right up front with all of them, and I would say, hey, look, this is what I do as a hobby. I race motorcycles. You know, I go at a fast speed. I'm at a track. You know, do you cover me? Will I be covered? Because I wanted to be very frank with them and get their answer. And so that's what you need to do as well, is call your own insurance company and just be frank with them. Tell them what you're going to be doing. But with that said, from calling all of the insurance companies that I called, and I think you got the same kind of response, the general consensus was, if you have a street bike and you want to do a track day, if it's considered a track school, where you're going to be learning. And when I called up these insurance companies, I asked them, you know, if I do a track school like the Oregon Motorcycle Safety Course or the Keith Code Superbike School, will I be covered if I am in a wreck? And for the most part, they all said yes. If you're doing a school, then you'll be covered. But at the same time, I would say, you know, what if I want to do a track day? And it was almost like as soon as you mention a motorcycle race track and the contents of doing a track day, they all were like, no. we're not going to cover you. If you have numbers painted on your bike, if it looks like it's a racing, you know, situation, we're not going to cover you. Some of them were so blunt they would say that would even drop your street coverage if they found out that you had some kind of motorcycle that you used on a racetrack. For the most part, I think it all comes down to really what's going through your mind. If you're going to sign up for a track school because you want to improve your skills, and you know, the PSSR group that I work for is a track day organization, but it's really a track school. We have, classroom sessions in between the, sessions on the track. And I know Cascade Track Time is also a track school. They have classroom sessions in between their sessions on the track. And so if you're going with the intention that I really want to do this as a school, I'm trying to improve my skills, I have a street bike, and I go to the class, then there's probably a good chance you're going to be covered if you have an accident. And I know from talking to several different people that I know from the track that they were covered when they did their first track school. But I also think that, you know, if you go and do a track school and have a crash and then you get covered by your insurance and then you say, well, I'm going to go do another track school, and you had another crash and then maybe another crash, I don't know how many times you're going to be able to do that before the insurance company is going to say, okay, this is not really a school. You keep going back over and over again, and you keep crashing. Maybe you're not learning. I'm not sure, but you're probably not going to be covered for the second or third time.
Right, and that's exactly the general gist that I got. And there is a knee-jerk reaction to the word racetrack. So one thing I would advise, and I'm not – you know, and just like Darren says, I'm not advocating, you know, trying to fraud your insurance company or anything like that. But realistically, if, you know, you're doing a track day and it's not like you have a dedicated track day bike, you know, you're just taking your street bike out there and maybe you're, you know, this is your first track day and all that sort of thing, you can treat it as a school depending on the organization you do it with. I talked to my independent agent who I actually don't get my motorcycle insurance through, but, you know, everything else. And she was really super helpful. And she suggested, you know, a few things. And one thing she said was call the actual company that you're dealing with. And so, like, it might be an agent for Allstate or whatever. You want to call Allstate rather than the agent. And you want to make sure you're not just talking to a customer service rep, but that you're talking to an actual underwriter. And make sure you explain that this is a school. And try not to mention the word racetrack. And I think you'll probably find that you would be covered. However, one thing also, the gist that I got from her is that if you have a motorcycle that is not street legal, it is, you know, it maybe not even registered at all, then you're not going to get coverage unless it's some sort of super specialty coverage. And even then, there was a wide variety of restrictions and things about the organization that you're there on the track with, meaning is various she actually said, you know, are they accredited? And I'm like, accredited with who? And, I'm not 100% sure. And these are questions that you're going to have to find out from your various insurance companies.
Right. And to go along with that, it was funny because we also, when I called, I would also ask them, I have a racing motorcycle. Could I just get coverage for theft or fire? And it was almost unanimous that if you have a racing motorcycle, they don't want anything to do with you. They don't want to cover you for theft. They don't want to cover you for, you know, anything. If it's not a street legal motorcycle, they don't want to talk to you. If it's not registered with DMV, they didn't want to talk to you. So, yeah, it was, which I was kind of surprised about. You know, you figure theft and fire, that really doesn't have anything to do with, you know, how you're using the vehicle. You're just trying to get it covered for theft. But they still were kind of like, no, we don't want to cover it.
Right. And that's another thing that actually I surprised me is that, yeah. And my agent did say you might be able to fall back on your homeowner's insurance if it, you know, if it was a fire or theft out of your house. But even then she said there was a limit of like $1,500. And it's like, you know, you guys will insure all my furniture and crap for God knows how much, but this motorcycle, you know, you won't touch. But unfortunately, I think the insurance companies may be what we have made them. And this is the nature of the beast. So you're somewhat going to have to just be your own insurance to a point. But it's definitely worth a call. That's the gist that I got out of it. So I don't know.
Yeah, and I also think, like I said, it goes along with what is going through your head. You know, if you have a nice street bike and you want to improve your skills, the best way to improve your skills is on a closed, you know, circuit, on a racetrack, and to take a race class. I mean, hands down, that is the best way to improve your street riding skills. And if that's what you're trying to do, and you've got a street bike, and you're like, hey, I want to go take the Keith Coates Superbike School, or I want to take a Cascade Track Time or a PSSR track school, to improve my skills, then most likely you are going to be covered. And like I said, I know people firsthand that were in that situation. Their very first track day, they went out and, you know, were taking their bike around and they crashed and they were covered.
Yeah.
But I also know that you just need to call and find out for yourself, because it was almost like the same insurance company. I mean, some of the people I've talked to was like, they had, you know, I won't say which one, but they had insurance company X, and one person was covered by him and one person wasn't covered by him. So it was almost like, you know, they didn't, I guess the second person who didn't get covered for his crash didn't word it correctly when he called in, or, you know, who knows what. But again, I think it comes down to just what's going through your head. Are you going out there just to have a fun time and do some track days? Well, then really you should get a track bike, or prepare your bike for, you know, to go down, get some race body work and some, you know, frame sliders and whatnot. And don't worry about calling into the insurance company. But yeah, if you're going to go out there, you want to do a class, a course to get yourself better prepared for street riding, check into it with your insurance company, but more than likely you're going to be covered.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think not to beat the whole insurance thing to, beating a flogging dead horse, but what Darren says is true. And also, again, not to defraud the insurance companies, but how you sort of word the whole claim is going to be a big difference. Because, for instance, the Oregon, the Motorcycle Safety Foundation here in Oregon that does the classes, and they have various levels of these classes, and the beginners and sort of medium level class they're done in a parking lot down at the fairgrounds with some cones and things like this. And I would think that there's no question that if you were riding your own motorcycle that you would be covered at a place like that. However, they do have an advanced class that's at a go-kart track up near Portland. And now this is not, you know, granted it's not, you know, Portland International Raceway, but it is still not a public road. So I would definitely, if I was trying to make a claim on that one, I'd be emphasizing the fact that I'm over there with the Team Oregon Motorcycle Safety Foundation, rather than, yeah, I'm riding at the go-kart track on Canby. And, you know, it's like I say, I'm not trying to promote, you know, insurance fraud or anything like that. I'm just saying you might want to be careful a little bit about the way you word these things if it happens to you. On the other hand, of course, the best bet is to try to avoid it in the first place. But, you know, these things do happen. So I think we've covered insurance pretty well, and it is it's an important topic. But equally, actually probably more important, is gear and how and what you need and the things that you can look for and so forth for the gear that you're going to need to go out and do track days.
Gear is probably is the most important part of your tracks, you know, your track experience, because the only thing between you and the asphalt is what you have on your body. If you're not in a cage, you're not in four wheels, you know, surrounded by a roll bar and all that kind of stuff. If you have a crash on a motorcycle, you're going to be on the ground, on the asphalt, and there's not going to be anything between you and your body and the asphalt besides what you have on. So when I first started getting into racing, I skimped on everything as far as the motorcycle, the tires. My first experience on the track, we talked about that already. But the one thing I didn't do is I didn't skip on gear, because I was like, you know, I only have one head, I only have two hands, I only have one body, and I don't want to get damaged in any way. So I always recommend that, you know, when you're starting your track experience, don't go for the cheapest thing that you can, you know, that you can get. Go with whatever the most you can afford as far as the gear you want to get. You know, the first thing we want to talk about and the most important thing is the helmet, because your head is the most important thing on your body. You can live without your hands, but you can't live without your head. And for myself, I know that when I try on different helmets, Arai, Shoei, Somi, my head is a different size. Everybody has a different size head, and so my head doesn't fit into an Arai helmet. Like, it just doesn't fit. It's uncomfortable. And so, you know, one of the things you want to do when you get a helmet is go to the store and try some different helmets on and see which one actually fits well. And when you get a helmet, you want it to fit very tight. You don't want to have it wiggle around at all. Basically, when you pull it down over your ears and you put the helmet on, grab onto the face of that helmet and yank it around. If you can move the helmet and not have your head move, even in the slightest bit, then it's probably not a good fit. You know, you want to be able to put that helmet on, and if that helmet gets yanked at all, up, down, right, left, your head should move the exact same distance as the helmet. You know, you want it to have a nice, tight fit. So beyond that, you want to look for just to make sure it's a certified helmet. There's been some reports out, you know, that I've read in the last few years that talk about the certifications and whether they're done correctly or not. But for the most part, you want it to fit secure and tight. My helmets in the past, when I first started riding a motorcycle, because I wear glasses, I also wear contacts, I would buy helmets, you know, so that I could put my glasses on in my helmet at the same time in case I didn't have my contacts in, which is really too loose. And so now I have a helmet that, I have a Xiaomi helmet. I mean, they're nice helmets. It's a tight helmet. I cannot wear it with my glasses. My glasses will not fit in at the same time I have my helmet on. But that's just the way they're supposed to be. But it is a nice fit. And the other thing that I like about those helmets is all of the inside padding is easily removed, so you can take it out and wash it and put it back in nice and easy.
For the dreaded helmet funk. And actually on that, with the glasses thing, this kind of fits in with some of like my military experiences with gas masks. You can get you can always get smaller frames, or even might be kind of tough to find out in the civilian world, but specialty glasses that look really, really stupid, but will fit inside almost anything. So that might be something if you do wear glasses and you want to get a helmet that's really good. And another thing to touch on that Darren that mentioned is talking about the certifications and all of that. And yeah, it's been a couple of years now, but Motorcyclist had that big article, Motorcyclist Magazine, big article about the Snell certifications. And the gist of it was that a Snell certification forces the helmet manufacturers to manufacture the outer shell too stiff, and that actually a plain old DOT certified helmet, or if you can get one of the European certifications, that those might actually be better because the shell flexes a little bit, and this is, you know, a little bit more flex. Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to slow your head down as when it impacts the concrete, and you start crushing the inner basically styrofoam of that helmet, and so if that outer shell can flex a little bit, and then your head starts crushing the styrofoam, that means your head is undergoing less G forces, and this is a good thing because G forces are bad for your brain. But by and large, any certified helmet, any DOT certified or even Snell certified helmet, will provide you a very, very high level of protection, whether it's a $50 helmet or a $700 helmet. But what the difference is, and Darren can attest to this, and so can I, is that if you spend that, you know, $300, $400 or whatever on a helmet for one of the quote unquote better brands, that helmet will be a lot more comfortable. And that can actually be a huge plus, particularly in street riding. I mean, you know, most states nowadays have helmet laws and all of that, but you're always maybe a little tempted to just take it for a quick ride around the block without the helmet or something like that, especially if your helmet is this agony to wear. So if you spend the extra money on a more comfortable helmet, that's always, I've thought, it's good advice. And another thing that Darren mentioned, where buy the best gear that you can afford, that's by far and away excellent advice. You know, find out how much you can afford, add 10 or 15% and stretch and make that and find it and to buy it. But moving on from the helmet, one thing, why don't we talk about suits real quick? And one thing I want to mention, and I'll get your input on this, Darren, is that I know that some track day organizations will allow in this C group, they will allow textile gear as opposed to leathers. Now, what's your kind of take on that one, Darren? What do you think about that?
I think the textile gear is fine, and a lot of track day organizations will allow that. The difference between the textile gear and your leather gear is the durability. With the textile gear, if you have a wreck and you go sliding down the asphalt for any kind of distance, the heat is going to melt that textile, and it's going to be a one use only. Where if you have a leather suit, then the leather is going to hold up longer. So if you already have a textile gear and you're thinking, I want to do a track day, I've never done one before, but I don't want to buy a full leather suit, well, you can do a track day in your it was a Kevlar, I guess, pants and jacket, and that's fine. As long as they zip together, I think one of the general rules that I've always seen at track days is that if you have a two-piece outfit, it does need to zip together at your waist. It doesn't have to be a one-piece, and it doesn't have to be a leather suit. It can be a textile, and like I said, I think they're fine for one crash. I think they're probably even, I've heard, equal in, as far as protection, as far as with a leather suit. It's just the leather suit's going to be better for the second or third crash, where the textile is going to be one and done.
Okay. That's an excellent take on that and good advice. And all right. And speaking about suits, this is something else that I kind of didn't know and I learned a little while ago, is that, you know, different suits are obviously going to suit different purposes. And there are companies out there, including Komodo, who's been a sponsor of MotoGPOD, Komodo, that makes suits specifically more geared for a track day rider rather than a race rider. Like, for instance, my suit. Darren will tell you that my suit's got a lot of padding. I mean, it makes my butt look really big. But it's sort of... maybe the philosophy is something along the lines of, you know, a less experienced rider, and I guess with that take, possibly more likely to go down, and that penalty of having sort of this extra weight, this extra size and mass is not, you know, that it's a trade-off, and that the padding is where they went with on that one. Is, I mean, so... not sure if that's something that you've sort of experienced with other companies or not, Darren, but I think that is somewhat true. So you might want to target your suit purchase for that sort of a desire, if that's the right word.
Yeah, and also I think you know, if you can afford to get a suit, let's say for example that you're a street rider and you're going to also do track days. So for a street rider, you know, let's say that you're actually a very conscious, safety concerned street rider, so you actually have a leather suit. And most street riders that I know, I think, is probably the two-piece leather suit's going to be more desirable, because you can take the jacket off when you get to wherever you're going and, you know, have your lunch and then put the jacket back on and take off back down the road.
Yeah.
But for the racetrack, the one-piece suit is actually a little bit more preferred. And a good example of that is just because the two-piece suit is not going to be as flexible. You're not going to be able to move around as easily on a motorcycle with a two-piece suit as you would to a one-piece suit. And the reason why is because the two-piece suit has a lot more stuff going on in the middle of it around your waist. You know, the jacket's got probably some kind of lower piece to it that is, you know, like you would find on a jacket, the bottom of the jacket. And then your pants, as far as a two-piece suit they're going to go, is going to have more around the waist as well as around the belt area. And then you're also going to have the zipper. And then wherever you have a zipper, there's probably going to be some overlap. So you just have a lot more material going on there. And it's just not going to be, you're not going to be able to move around as easily when you're on the racetrack and on the street as well.
Huh.
So a one-piece suit is going to be a little bit easier. You're going to be, you know, one of the first things that I think people learn when they're on the track is body position on the motorcycle. You know, leaning off the bike, getting their butt off the bike, you know, getting their arms and their knees kind of over towards the side when they're going through the turn, and then repositioning themselves. And if you're on a track that has a few consecutive turns in a row, you need to be able to switch back and forth, you know, on the bike. And with a one-piece suit, you're going to be a lot more comfortable doing that. You're going to be able to jump around a lot easier. If you have a two-piece suit, it's just going to be more bulky. You're going to find that it's not as easy to move around. You know, you're not going to be as comfortable. You're going to feel like you're actually having to force yourself to move over more because the suit is restricting you.
Interesting thought, and not one that I'd actually thought of, but I that makes a whole lot of sense, actually. And I do. When I go out on like the classic sort of Sunday ride sort of thing, I wear my suit. I figure it's better to sweat than bleed, and you know, plus you look cool. So, but for commuting, you know, no, I'm a jeans and a leather jacket kind of guy. So sort of taking my chances on the commute. But you know, I'm also not sort of riding the same roads or as aggressively as on a Sunday ride, and on the track, certainly it's you know, you're wearing gear, and that's just the way
right.
It is.
And another thing about the leather suit, if you do go out and buy a suit just for the racetrack and you buy a one-piece suit, like I said, with the helmet, you want it to fit very tight. The suit also, you want it to fit very tight. And when I know, when I first was trying on suits and when I first started getting into the racing, I was told that basically if you can put the leather suit on and stand up straight, it's too big. You want to have a very, very tight suit. One of the things is if you buy a new suit, it's going to stretch out a little bit, first of all. But also, you're thinking, you want to buy a suit, it's going to be tailored so you can sit on a motorcycle, you know, in your crotch position. My suit, I've had it for 5 years now, and if I'm off the bike and trying to walk to the bathroom and I've got it fully zipped up, it's not comfortable. You know, my suit is a very tight suit. And the reason why you want it tight is because you want it to be skin tight. If you go down and you're crashing and you're sliding down the track, if your suit is skin tight, then it's going to wear much better than if you have a suit that is actually a little bit larger in size and maybe has some room to, you know, so that you're comfortable when you're not on your bike, you're kind of standing around, it's nice and comfy, you know, you got some room in there to wiggle around in. Well, what that happens is when you're sliding on the track, that wiggle room actually can turn into folds. And so then as you're scraping down the asphalt, that becomes a wear point and will actually wear the suit out much faster. You'll get a hole there.
Hmm. Interesting. Good point. One thing, though, that you do need a little bit of room for in your suit is a back protector.
Correct.
Another piece of gear. And again, this isn't actually sometimes, I think PSSR now requires them in all groups, and they used to be optional in a couple of the groups or something like that. But I would think that, again, a relatively small amount of money to add on to your total bill, because let's face it, it's an expensive hobby, it's worth it. Let's get the back protector.
And the back protectors, you know, this is one area. Okay, so I say, you know, buy a helmet that fits nice, that's comfortable, and is nice and tight. Buy a suit that is, a substantial leather suit. If you're going to buy a dedicated track suit, you don't want to get a leather suit that's nice and tight, or a kangaroo skin, I guess, is the other thing that they use. And you also want to just look at the stitching, make sure it's a well-built suit. The difference between a $200 or $300 suit and a $1,000 suit, again, the $200 or $300 suit is probably going to be fine for one or two crashes, except the $1,000 suit, if it's fit well, is going to be fine for a dozen or more crashes. So again, you're spending more money up front, but you're getting more out of it if you plan on doing track days for a while and you want to have it last a while. But the back protector, I've seen it. Back protectors, some of them cost like $300, and I've also seen back protectors that cost $50. And I think the $50 back protector, you know, it is probably just as good as the $300 back protector. The $300 back protectors I've seen, they kind of, you know, they have a full body system where they kind of wrap around your shoulders and they tie around your waist and, you know, they hold it right in place. Well, my leather suit is so tight that if I have my back protector on, my leather suit is going to hold that back protector in place. So I have actually the $50 back protector. It's not a real expensive one. It has one little strap that goes around my belly that Velcros. And if I don't wear if I just put it on without my leather suit, then yeah, it's really pointless because it's going to be flopping all over the place and sliding down, and it's not going to be any use at all. But when it's underneath my leather suit is going to hold it in place. And the back protector is just a series of, you know, hard plastic, you know, ribs or shells, almost like I'm trying to think of the animal,
like an armadillo.
Armadillo, right. That goes down and protects your back, and that's really what you need. So that is one area where you don't necessarily have to spend the top dollar. But you can get a back protector that is going to protect your back just as much for a lot less. It's just going to be a lot less features on it. But again, if you have a leather suit that's tightly fitted, it's going to hold it in place.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And then, one last thing to touch on real quick about suits is, again, the comfort issue. And also, so much of this stuff is a lot better if you can go to the store and try it on. I wouldn't suggest buying anything like on the internet unless you know that that's going to fit. And, if you've bought that same helmet several times before or whatever. But one thing about the suits with the comfort thing is venting. And you may or may not want perforated leathers. It's going to depend on where you live, the times of year that you ride, all that sort of thing. But it gets hot. It's real hot. And so I'm a big fan of the venting. They might have a little air vents on the shoulders and things like that, and some zippers that'll open up to allow air in, just like the street jackets. And the leather may or may not be perforated. So that's something to think about as well, those are the features you might want to look for in that suit.
Yeah, but also something to consider. I know when I first bought my suit, I was concerned about the heat, and so when I was looking for leather suits, I wanted to get like a light-colored suit, you know, almost like a white suit to kind of reflect, you know, whatever, you know, sun was on me. And when I was at the store, almost all the suits were black. And I was talking to somebody, and I was like, well, isn't it black? Isn't that going to absorb some heat? And he had a good point. He was like, you know, if it's 100 degrees outside and you're wearing a leather suit, you're going to be hot. So if you live in Southern California and you're going to go race at Willow Springs Raceway, you just have to be prepared that when you have your suit on, you're going to be hot.
Exactly.
Now, once the green flag drops or once your session starts, your mind is going to forget all about the heat and you're going to have a fun time. And then as soon as your session stops, you're going to be hot.
Right.
So, you know, that goes along with drinking lots of water and being prepared for the track day. But, yes, you do want to have a perforated suit. That all helps. But, again, you know, you are wearing a leather suit.
Exactly. And that's something I've heard about the kangaroo is that it's just insanely hot compared to cowhide. But it's much more durable for the weight. So, you know, it all boils down to the type of rider you're going to be and what you can afford and all of those sorts of things. But, you know, always go for, you know, figure out what you can afford, add 10 or 15% and get at least that. Then last couple of items, I think it would be boots and gloves. Anything real specific on those, Darren, that you kind of got?
With the gloves, you know, again, you want to make sure they fit nice and tight. You don't, you know, again, gloves can be really expensive. I've seen gloves cost like $300 or more, and the gloves that cost $300 or more have a lot of bling to them. They, you know, they've got some metal, you know, across your knuckles, and they look like they came from the Mad Max movies. And I've always kind of stayed away from them because I'm like, really, what's the purpose, you know, besides the look? And if you're on the racetrack, if you're doing, track days, people are going to, nobody cares about what your gloves look like. So you can usually get away with some good durable gloves. The one thing I would say, and something I've learned just from experience, is some of the gloves that the gloves I had when I first started racing, the fingers had to make them more flexible. They had kind of like almost like we talked about the armadillo skin. You can kind of imagine that where the knuckles were, there would be kind of a piece that would stick up a little bit past the knuckles. So if you had your fingers straight, the glove was nice and smooth. But if you curved your fingers around, there was little, you know, wings or ribs on the knuckles, uh-huh, and, you know, in two places. And when I first bought my gloves, I didn't think anything of it. And that's what I was like, okay, I'll basically make your fingers more flexible. But I actually had an experience while I was racing where, you know, it was like the last lap. I was, you know, had taken a few laps to catch up to this guy. You know, it was probably my first year racing, I think. So I think I was battling for a top 10 finish. And, you know, there was somebody, a carrot in front of me, and I had reeled him in over the course of a few laps. And it was the last lap, and I was like, okay, I'm going to make my pass here. And I had a full throttle, and I dropped the throttle, and I went to grab the clutch to shift, to downshift. And those little wings on my knuckles actually caught onto the clutch lever.
Oh, wow.
And at the time, you know, again, you have to imagine that if you're street riding and this happened, you would be like, oh, what's this? Okay, I caught my fingers. Oh, well, I'll just move my fingers down and I'll, you know, reposition my hand. But when you're racing and you're at the, you know, you're in the moment and you have to react within a split second, it was like, you know, the split second that my hand was caught onto my lever and I was like, ah, what's going on here? And I think I almost ran off the track and totally blew it and the guy got away. So, and now whenever I buy gloves, I don't buy those little wing things. I just buy gloves that fit.
Yeah.
And the other thing about, we talk about boots, and boots, again, can be very expensive. And I think when you get to the higher end cost in boots, you're buying more bling. You're buying, you know, more stuff, more little flashy things on the boots. I buy just some basic standard boots. The one thing I look for is that they've got removable or replaceable toe sliders.
Yes.
And also toe sliders. I think that's about it, toe sliders, because I do drag my toes on the asphalt just as much or more than I drag my knees. And so my very first pair of boots, I didn't have replaceable toe sliders. And so within the first year, I had worn down the boot through to my toe.
I had to get new boots, yeah.
and I had to get new boots. Hmm.
Another thing I want to, one thing about gloves that I've learned is, you know, any glove that's suitable for the track is going to be like a gauntlet where it's coming up your arm. Go for as much coming up your arm as you can. Basically the longest gloves that you can find, one advice. And this is from a street crash that I had where I had a pair that I thought were good. You know, they came over my wrists and stuff, and it's not enough. You need it. That needs to come up your arm, and it should be tight again, very tight. And with the boots, I'm a big fan of support, because if you do go down, you might, you know, if you're unlucky enough to have a high side or something like that, you might be cartwheeling or flipping around or something like that. And anything that you can do to sort of keep your ankles and feet from bending in unusual directions is probably a good thing.
I agree.
Well, I think we covered us from head to toe on the gear. We talked about insurance, and we started the whole thing off with target fixation. So,
yeah, and the last tip I have, we'll put track days to a rest until next December, but what I always tell people is plan out your year at the beginning of the year. So, you know, sit down with, you know, when you want to start doing some track days, you know, look at your schedule for the next, you know, for the upcoming summer, and figure out how many track days you can afford to do. If you can afford to do two or three or four, and buy it in bulk. I think every track day organization I know gives you a break if you buy, you know, more than one at a time. If you buy two or three, then you'll get a little bit of a discount, so you kind of save some money there. And it's also good, I think, just to kind of think, okay, I got these track days coming up. I got one in June, I got one in July, I got one in September, and you can kind of plan your summer around it. Makes the summer go by real nice and enjoyable.
Yes, you've always got something to look forward to, because sometimes with these things, you're all geared up and you're anticipating it for several weeks, and then you go do it and you have a great, great, great time. But there's this letdown afterwards that, well, now it's done. I don't have it to look forward to anymore.
right. Yes. And then, if you get it all planned out, you can do one, you know, in the, throughout the summer. And then when October comes around, you can just be like a regular AMA racer and be depressed all winter long until the spring, summer comes.
Yes. Go out and lovingly touch your motorcycle and, oh, my. Yeah. this whole track day thing, I know we do need to wrap up this call, but I do want to say this whole track day thing has generated so much email, and there's so many people that are, you know, interested in and excited about it. And it is something that really, if you have a sporty motorcycle, actually, if you have any motorcycle, you can do one. And you can at least do one. And so, you know, you've got the gear. Maybe you'll have to buy a set of textile pants that zip up to your jacket or something like that. And, you know, a minimal amount of expenditure. And then you drop the, you know, the hundred and whatever dollars it is for the day itself. Go out there and you will become quickly addicted. And, you know, these organizations are much like pushers. It's sort of cheap the first time. And then after that, it starts getting more expensive. But, you know, it's an excellent hobby. It's lots of fun. It makes you a better rider. And it's an excellent outlet too. And one thing, like Fergus, our buddy that we took down to Thunder Hill, has found and feels that he can't ride on the street anymore and keep it, you know, even quasi legal. So the track is his outlet. I think he was saying that that's all he's going to do anymore. So that's another thing to think about.
And yeah, you might give up your street riding after you do a track day.
Right. And I mean, you know, it's not like, you know, I haven't personally, but I also live in a lot different area than Darren and Fergus. And I can get away with going fast. Not that I would advocate breaking the law or anything like that. But it's still something to think about, that you're in there and it's such an environment that it's just so much safer. Because that's another thing. You know, a lot of guys, oh, my wife won't let me. Yeah, it's so much safer on the track.
Yeah.
It really is. For one, there's an ambulance half a minute away. You know,
right?
You're not going to get that on the freeway or some country back road. You'll be laying out there for hours.
But right. What? It's the safest place to ride a motorcycle
by far and away. Yes. So, all right, Darren, it's been great talking with you. Had you on the show, and thank you very much for all your insight. I think it's valuable information, and we will probably be doing another one of these, you know, before too long, or if maybe even it's next winter during that off season. But it's been good stuff. So, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's show. Hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much for downloading it. I do appreciate it. Things have been so busy lately. Like I was complaining about in the last episode, I've just been swamped. But I think things are going to level out a little bit here. So we are taking a break next week. No show February 1st, but I will be back February 8th. We'll talk about the testing that went on in Phillip Island, which is going on. Now it's in the future right now, but on our next show, it will be in the past. So we can talk about it. So that's happening, I believe, 29th, 30th, 31st. 1st of January down there in Phillip Island, which is the middle of their summer, which must be nice that it's a little bit warmer because it's damn freezing in Oregon this week. And other than that, I think that about covers it. Do consider please making a donation there to Ian Carty's effort for Cycle to Can. You can do that at cycle2can.org. And check out the links on the website about the variety of other things. And I think that about covers it. So, all right. Until 2 weeks from now, a fortnight, as they say. We'll see ya. Keep the shiny side up. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorner Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorner Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them. It's alive. Yes, Mithery. Set up for the name, the other's house, and the master of the 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 house, and